I put this particular topic into the Bible class program for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it's part of the number of signs which are in the Gospel of John, the events around the Pool of Siloam. And the Gospel of John, of course, is chosen very carefully. Half of it occurs in the last month about of Jesus' life. In the 10th chapter of John, we have the Feast of Dedication mentioned, which is modern-day Hanukkah. And there are, of course, 21 chapters in John, so you can see that the last half of it, anyway, takes place in the last 4 months of Jesus' life. What this means is that things are chosen very carefully. And the other thing, of course, is that almost all of John's gospel occurs in and around Jerusalem. Not all of it, but most of it. So what this means is that John chooses the first half of the gospel quite carefully to build up to the events which were immediately preceding and immediately following the death and the resurrection, which and, of course, the emblems which we celebrate on a Sunday. There are 6 signs in John's gospel. First one is the wine at Cana. Second was the healing of a young child. And the third is the man who had been lame for, 38 years, if I remember the number correctly. And that's the third sign. The fourth sign is the bread feeding of the 5,000. The fifth sign is the one we're going to look at shortly. And the sixth sign is the raising of Lazarus. So, as we've said previously, the wedding at Cana and the wine which was produced, the first one, is associated with Passover. The fourth sign, which was the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of bread and fish to that population, is again associated in the text with the concept of Passover. And then the third Passover, of course, is the time when the events of the upper room take place. The other 4 signs, the healing of a child, the lame man, and the concept of lameness is picked up in the prophets. The healing of the blind man, which we'll look at a little later, and the raising of Lazarus, of course, pick us up through the concepts of human infirmity and then give us an indication of what's coming in resurrection with, of course, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. So John's gospel then is structured very carefully to make the points which surround the events in the upper room and the resurrection of Jesus, which occur right at the end of his gospel. And which, as I say, a great deal of that takes up a rather large portion of John's gospel. I have 3 reasons for picking this topic, and one of them, I'm going to give you a little commercial announcement now, because a number of years ago, the meeting bought a series of slides, and I have taken 5 or 6 of them out. We'll look at them shortly. And they deal with the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant and its wanderings throughout the land of Israel. They deal with the structure of the temple, particularly with the temple in the time of our Herod's temple, and they also deal with the city of Jerusalem at the time when Jesus was there. Now, if you've never been to Israel and visited Jerusalem and so forth, I can quite see you having being nervous about picking up a set of pictures and thinking that you can use them. But don't be afraid of them. This is a terrific resource which the meeting bought. And apart from the time when we first bought them and used them in a series of lectures, Clyde used them for a couple of lectures on that occasion, I'm the only one that's taken them out of hibernation and used them at Sydney and Prince George and places like that, and here on a couple of occasions. One of our arranging brethren, Brother Stephen, said that what we should really do probably is get them digitized and then maybe more people would use them. But unfortunately, I'm technically illiterate and proud of it and will stay that way. So it's not a task that I am going to undertake or could undertake. I don't know. Actually, it occurred to me while I was sitting there, Clyde, maybe what we should do is put a note in the newsletter and just make an appeal for somebody to put them in a form where they would be more widely used. So that's the commercial. What I'm going to do now is try and turn this FM thing on, and then if we can turn the slides on and put the lights down a bit. And I'm going to use this stick as a pointer. Am I functioning? This is a slide that I've used a number of occasions. It's one that we took on our first trip to Jerusalem, which is now many years ago. And you're looking, of course, at what's known as the Dome of the Rock. Tradition has it that the Dome of the Rock is right over the high point of Mount Moriah, and that this was therefore the place where the Holy of Holies was when Solomon built the temple at the top of that mountain. You remember that Abraham took Isaac to the top of Mount Moriah. That was Mount Moriah then that was selected to be the site of the temple in the time of Solomon. And Solomon built his temple on the top of the mountain. So this midpoint here is as closely as we can determine, and I'll talk about this a little later. It's another reason for you reading the text that the Rittmeyers give. But we'll talk a little bit more about the ideas which do set the site of the temple and the holy place immediately underneath that dome. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that the temple which Herod restructured, because Herod actually built over the temple that was there at the time, that had been built by in the time of Nehemiah and Zerubbabel, that he built outside it so that the worship could go on in the holy place and in the courtyard of the temple uninterrupted. But the structure that Herod built on the outside of what was the temple, the Hasmonean temple, has actually exceeded the height that you see there in the dome. So when the apostles took Jesus up onto the Mount of Olives to show him the wonders of the temple, they saw a structure which was at least as grand or greater than what you see there in this present Dome of the Rock. Now, what we're going to do is go along this surface here, this wall along there. Firstly, this is a map of Jerusalem, and the temple structure is here. City of David hung on the side of a hill here, and we'll have a look at how that was structured in a few minutes. Pool of Siloam was fed by a spring, which was about here, and in Hezekiah's day, of course, the tunnel was prepared to take water to the Pool of Siloam, which is about this point inside the city itself. Mount Zion is mislabeled about here. It's more of that direction. David's time, the city was sort of hung on the edge of the hill like this. The Jebusite city was approximately the same size, again, in about that structure. The temple to the north. So when the temple was built by Solomon in this area here, the royal palaces of David and Solomon would have been here, the sort of, as it were, more upscale areas of the city in this area, and the ordinary people then down the hillside in that direction. So as I said, what we're doing, this is the Dome of the Rock, of course. What we're doing is going to sort of work our way along here. You notice the vegetation in here. You're at the bottom of a valley, and there's a natural watercourse, the Brook Kidron, flows along the bottom of this valley. Here is the city of David. This is the modern-day temple structure. In the time of Solomon, the temple area would have stopped about there. The Hasmoneans in the Maccabean time extended it here. Herod extended the temple platform even further, and that's the current size of the temple platform.
The spring Gihon is somewhere in this area here. And that's the spring which fed the pool of Siloam. So here's a close-up of the city of David. And the spring is down below us, somewhere in this area here. No, probably right there, because I think that's the tower that we'll see in a few minutes. Spring is here, and the water was taken to a point further down there. Now, the thing is that in Isaiah, am I in front of you guys, or can you see what's going on? Yeah. In Isaiah, there's a little phrase which says in 8th chapter of Isaiah that the waters of Siloam flow softly. Nowadays, if you go near the pool, it seems to gush. And indeed, it says in John that the water, the Siloam, means scent. This seems to pick up the idea that water is coming out. It's not so much that the water is being sent. The water is being sent to you. It's gushing. So that seems to be the original idea. And the spring Gihon is probably a corruption, Greek corruption as much as anything, of a Hebrew word, which again means to come, to gush out, to come forth. So the spring was flowing. And yet in Isaiah's time, it talks about the waters flowing softly. In addition, in Ecclesiastes, second chapter of Ecclesiastes, there's a point made that I built me pools and planted forests and planted trees. And it's generally ascribed to Solomon. So what we're looking at probably was a structure which took the water from the spring here and fed it in an irrigation channel going all the way along below the city walls, which at the time of David, as you'll see, and as we'll see again shortly, followed the ridge of the hill. And then along this irrigation channel, there were little wooden gates which you lift up every now and again, and water then would flow into the channel, and when you lifted the gate, come out onto the particular fields that you were interested in irrigating. So in Isaiah, and again in Ecclesiastes, the water from Spring Gihon was channeled along the outside of the city wall and was used to irrigate fields for agricultural production. And we have those two references, as I say, in the Old Testament for that purpose. And, of course, this was outside the city wall. And so in the time of Hezekiah, when the Assyrians were on their way, Hezekiah said, why should they have all the water? And they blocked off the spring and put that tunnel and brought it out into the area, that into a reservoir that we think of as the Pool of Siloam. Now, this is a slide that Henry Bird found. I kicked myself many times for not buying this slide. I didn't notice it in the collection there, but Henry had a good eye for all sorts of things, and he bought it, and he gave me a couple of copies, and here's one of them. It's interesting to see the contours. This is the top of the mountain. Now, this contour, we don't know for sure, but we're reasonably accurate. Fairly flat top. This ridge was where the Jebusite city was, because the spring is down below it here. So the Jebusite city just came along the ridge, so that with steep sides here and a more gradual ascent and a fairly steep side going in there, although this has now been filled in and is much higher, fairly steep valleys on both sides. So it was fairly defensible except from the north. And this is the northern side there. Now, if you take the trouble to read the booklets that accompany this set of slides, Lee Rittmeyer was one of the few people who has actually got onto the top of the mountain underneath the Dome of the Rock. This is a Muslim site, and they're very fussy about who they allow into this area. But he succeeded in talking his way into that. And you can read in his booklets the evidence that he feels shows that that was where the holy place was structured. He feels that there are an imprint of foundations on the top of the rock. And also the overall structure of the rock, he describes, so that it seems entirely likely that this was indeed a suitable place for a threshing floor for the wind to blow the chaff away. And you record that's what God instructed David was needed, and David purchased that for the site of the temple, and Solomon then put the temple on that site. So this relatively flat area on the top, and then very steep ridge along here. The city of David hung on to this little ridge here, and the temple was built to the north with an east-west axis. This is a Maccabean tower. It's built just above the spring, because the spring, of course, could be got at from the outside quite easily. And so a defensive tower was built above the spring Gihon. And it appears to have been there, even from, it seems to be recorded when Nehemiah walked around the city. There are references in that place where he walked around, which indicate that there had been towers built in the time of Solomon, above the spring, so that you could take up a defensive position above the spring and, of course, shoot down and protect that water supply. It certainly has been rebuilt many times, a tower in that area. But it indicates to you the importance of water and the stress that was placed on it. This is a Ritmeyer slide. That's the structure of the temple. The old city came in this direction. Siloam, this is the main reservoir, and a portico structure built by Herod, which actually received the water from Hezekiah's tunnel. And then the overflow went into this main reservoir, and then the overflow from the reservoir went down and irrigated the fields here. And we'll pick up this point again when we come to John a little later on, that the surface, the soil in that area, shows the influence of the flowing water for many years. This is the place where Herod set up his palace, and there are three towers in here. The biggest tower was built in honor of his wife, whom he later had subsequently murdered. So, Herod is not a very nice character, and even though there's no evidence for the slaughter of the children in Nazareth, more than likely, it's not out of character with Herod for that to have been there. The wealthy suburb was in this area. Priest's house, there's a palace here mentioned, and that was a palace from the priests at the time of the Maccabees. These were palaces used by the priests. Priests would process along here every morning, along this road, this main road, into the temple itself. You notice the density of houses. It gradually gets that there are fewer and better and larger structures in this way. In this direction also was the sort of merchant class. So in the time of Jesus, it was there were a lot of enormous buildings there, and indeed Jerusalem itself, including all the water supplies. The Pool of Bethesda is just to the north of the temple in here. Pool of Siloam in this area. There were 17 of these pools scattered around Jerusalem in Herod's day. And this open area by the temple here was a shopping district. And that area here, there are stores all the way along here. So it was a place that tourists came to. It was a tourist destination in the days of Herod for people from all over the Roman Empire. And you can get all of that information out of the Ritmeyer books. This is the little pool that tunnel which Hezekiah built to take the water from the spring Gihon and take it inside the city and inside the walls. This is the pool as it is today. This was taken the day before the Day of Atonement. It's a Ritmeyer slide. And he says the Jews there were following a procedure which is based on the prophet Micah, and they were where it says that their sins shall be cast into the sea. And this is part of the ritual associated with the Day of Atonement as it is followed today. So that's there. The other thing which we have is that the water from this pool, the Pool of Siloam, was used in the Day of Atonement for the water libation, which you remember, and then on the actual day. And the golden flagon was dipped into a pool and taken up to the temple. And the water was also used as the water which was used to accept the ashes of the red heifer. So Pool of Siloam has featured quite importantly in Jewish ritual over the years. Here's the reservoir and the overflow for the reservoir in the days of Herod came out into this area here. Just up in that area is portico structure. We'll look at it again. So this again is the sort of information which are there in the slides. The Rittmeyers are both competent archaeologists, and there's a lot of visual information as well as written information which accompany the slide. This is one of our slides. I put it in because it illustrates the type of roadway which was in use in the time of Herod, the time of the Maccabees, time of Herod, time of Jesus. A flat sort of area which may slope slightly, a step or two, flat area, so that you come up in a series of steps, rises, and then flattened areas to walk on. So you come up slowly. So this, then, is the Herodian walkway, which was constructed, as I indicated to you, with that step and a flat area and a step and a flat area. And there's the portico. That was the actual pool of Siloam. That the pool which accepted the water which came through Hezekiah's tunnel. So what we read in John took place here. That the eyes of that blind man were anointed, as the phrase is in John, with the clay spittle that Jesus spat on the ground, made a sort of paste of clay, put it on his eyes and said, "Now go wash in the Pool of Siloam." It was a meeting place. It was a place where people went, not just for water, but if you notice from those earlier slides, the number of places where there were open areas that you could go and talk to people, you can meet outside the little courtyard that you might have in your house. They're very, very few. And so people congregated in areas like this. And so that's a point to keep in mind, that people would have seen what went on. Because that was where people went. Place to sit, it's cool around the water, nice place to be, nice structure. This portico, these Herodian sort of porches and balconies and so forth. It was a very, very pleasant place to be. So we need almost, so we can turn that thing off now if you, somebody will be so kind. And then turn a few lights on, and I will get rid of the FM business, and we'll come back to this one. So, John 9. As we said at the start, this is the one of a series of six signs, the fifth sign. And it is, there are sort of two groups of signs, as it were. There's the bread and wine symbolism, and then there's the healing, the focus on human infirmity, and this is one of those. We're not going to talk, we could have picked up the one about the blind man, but I thought it would be interesting to show you a few slides, and also to publicize this resource that we have here, the temple model and the pictures and text that go with it. There are two or three things going on here. One of them
of course, is the sense that the Jews had in the first century of what was wrong with people and why it happened. The whole concept of disease and infirmity was approached totally differently than it is nowadays. There was a widespread feeling that plagues came because God was dissatisfied with you. The statement is made quite clearly here that who was responsible for this man being blind? Had he done something that caused him to be blind, or his parents? It seems that people realized that he had been blind for a rather long time, whether they'd known him from birth or not. That they are aware that he had been blind at least from childhood. That seems very, very clear. And John makes it very plain that indeed he had always been blind. He had never seen ever in his lifetime. So the question was asked, and interestingly, it's asked by people who should know better. Who was responsible for his blindness? Who had sinned? If you read some of the historical analysis on the Gospels, you find that there's a very cynical approach taken to this particular event. When Jesus said he's blind so that we can demonstrate the works of God, most modern commentators look at that and think of it as a, well, look at me response. I am here to do something, and this man has been prepared for me to do it. I rather think that what we should do is look at all of these things as being a response to an opportunity. Not that he had been prepared in order to show this, but rather that there were many around in this state, and Jesus took advantage of this man. And why did he use this particular individual? And that comes out as the story develops. We then go from this initial incident of who was responsible for it. Was it him or somebody else who had sinned and caused this? To the statement that Jesus must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And so we go instantly from this thought of not being able to see to the idea that there are times when none of us can see because it's dark, to the idea that when Jesus is there, you should be able to see because he is the light of the world. So it's a symbolic thing which is being stressed here. But the point is made. That in this man's blindness, there is an opportunity to see the light of the world. And that takes us right back to the statements which were made in Luke particularly, surrounding the anticipated birth of Jesus, that he was to be a light to lighten the Gentiles, and so forth. Now, when he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground. One thing that you should have got from the image of first century Jerusalem, which was on the screen a few minutes ago, was the idea that it's a very densely packed city. There weren't many areas where there was soil. Now, it says he made clay. Now, was that really clay? More than likely, because the word which is used here is used again in Romans, and there it says, hath not the potter power over the ground, the clay, which is here. So it's almost certain that what we're looking at here is something which had an actual clay-like consistency. Where did it come from? It didn't scrape up dust off the soil, off the street. And you see, you come to other interesting little questions here. Because typically we think of John's gospel, if you read comments on when John was written and so forth, the idea seems to be that John was written sometime early in the second century AD. So that was at least 50 years after, a good 50 years after Jerusalem had been destroyed. John sets almost all of his description in Jerusalem. And if it was written a generation or two after anybody had lived in Jerusalem and seen it, where did his information come from? And that's the question that the people who study biblical texts in great deal, in great depth, come up with now. Today, the area where the just below the Pool of Siloam is referred to as a clay soil area. And within this area, there are all kinds of trees which grow naturally because of the seepage water which comes from that which is fed by the spring which has been diverted and still flows into the area where the Pool of Siloam was in Jesus' day. So where did the soil come from that Jesus used to make the clay that he put on the man's eyes? Probably from just outside the walls. And if you go to these areas and look at much of the soil which is there nowadays, a lot of it is very silty. It doesn't have this consistency that you can make a paste and actually make sort of an ointment. But from the area near the Pool of Siloam, you can do that. Now, it's pure speculation, and it's speculation on my part, partly by bits that I've read, and partly from the things that we've seen when we've been there. But it would appear that what Jesus did was encounter this man just outside the city wall. That there they met, and that Jesus went maybe further on up into the city, up those stairs that you saw in the last slide. And the man went into the pool to wash his eyes and receive his sight. It's interesting that there are little possibilities which raise themselves when you look at the text and what the text says. And these possibilities indicate to us that indeed John's gospel is founded on a pretty good knowledge of what Jerusalem was like around 30 AD. And Jesus said to the man in the 7th verse, go wash in the Pool of Siloam, which by interpretation is sent. And as I indicated to you, what I think that that word means and what that word indicates is that the water is coming out, that the water is being moved. He went his way, therefore, and washed and came seeing. And the neighbors, therefore, and they which before had seen him that he was blind said, isn't this the blind guy? And some said, well, it can't be because we've never seen such a thing happen before. And that point is made in a couple of occasions in John. There's never been an occasion when a blind man has been cured. So what's gone on here? It's got to be somebody that looks like him. It can't possibly be a blind man who is cured because that has never happened. That's also, it's interesting how often modern ideas are encountered in an old gospel. Because any one of the scholarly people, and many of the modern day churchmen, say, I have difficulty with the concept of a miracle. I can't accept it. Because it's so far outside human experience. Many years ago, there was a gentleman by the name of Bishop Barnes, who was Bishop of Birmingham. And in the 50s, he came out with the outlandish statement that he couldn't believe in the resurrection because it was completely outside human experience. People don't come back from the dead. That's what the Jews are saying here. The idea has been with us all along. And what Jesus is saying is, it is possible. Why? Because he was doing the work of his Father. And with his Father, anything like that is entirely possible, because God claims to be responsible for us as living creatures in the first place. And to simply transform things a little bit is not at all difficult and is not at all outside the realm of possibilities insofar as a creator is concerned. So it's interesting, as I said, that the ideas which are presented here by the Jews, and there are several cases where modern ideas are used as critics of what Jesus said, are used in John. There are two or three places, very prominent places, where modern-day criticism is picked up against Jesus. So, where are we now? And they said, well, how were your eyes opened? And he said, well, he anointed my eyes, told me to go to the pool of Siloam, which is verse 11, and went and received sight. And then they said to him, where is he? Where is this man? And the man who had been cured said, I don't know. I don't know. Why stop at that point? Why stop at the place where the man says, I don't know? Because only an hour or so ago, he couldn't have known. He couldn't have seen. Jesus would have had to speak to him, and he would have had to recognize Jesus' voice. If he hadn't seen him before, he would have no idea. No idea who he was talking to. Now, he could see, but he couldn't see Jesus. But, and this is interesting, because it moves on down. The idea moves on down. And that's the real reason that this man became an object for Jesus' healing. It comes to it as the chapter wears on. The other thing is that it happened on the Sabbath. Now, we know from much of the writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls that Sabbath was a point of intense debate in the time of Jesus. The people in the Dead Sea Scrolls had a series of prescriptions. You can do this, but you can't do that. And he even went so far as to rescuing animals that were in trouble. And the whole idea behind the Essenes and that group was that if an unfortunate thing happened, it must be the will of God, so we're not going to intervene. If it happens on the Sabbath, it's the will of God that it should happen on that day, and we are not going to break our prescription to do no work on the Sabbath day for any reason whatsoever. That was one extreme position. Josephus gives us another series of ideas about what was being discussed surrounding Sabbath worship at this time. It was a very period of intense debate. And what we have here is one of the positions in that debate, which said that you would not, we can wait another day. You could heal the guy tomorrow. That would have been all right. For him to be blind another day was no hardship to anybody. Why didn't you wait? And that was the point which was being stressed by the Pharisees. Why don't you stay with Sabbath law, when it was not essential that this thing be done today? And that was one of the points of debate which was going on at that time. So they're gradually building up their case. Now, if you look at the previous chapter, the eighth chapter, you find that the same people said to Jesus, now, we're Abraham's children, our father Abraham. And they appealed to their father Abraham. And Jesus said to them that he had come to that Abraham rejoiced to see his day. And not only that, Abraham actually saw his day and was glad. So Abraham's faith took him to the point where Jesus should arrive. And Jesus threw it back at them and said, okay, what's your position now? In this chapter, they appeal to Moses. And there, you see, you're starting to get to Sabbath law. They appeal to Moses and everything that went along with the writings of Moses, Sabbath law and all that, and the things that they had built on the writings of Moses, because they had Moses to their start. So what did Jesus have? And that was the point that they raised. And already, and so I'll sort of wind down now. I was told off a couple of times ago by our esteemed brother in the back row that I speak too long in Bible classes, so I'll make an effort to finish in 2 minutes, Mac. Yeah. These words spake the parents. Now, because what had happened was that the scribes, the Pharisees, and those people had determined that there should be no effect of Jesus in the synagogue. He was barred from the synagogue. And if you claimed to belong to Jesus and to believe in him, you too were going to be barred from the synagogue. They did not want to be ostracized by their friends. So their response was that, yes, he's our boy, but we don't know what happened. We have no idea how he got to be this. Yes, he was blind. We know that. But how his situation had changed, we don't know. The man had said a little while earlier, I don't know where he is. But what happened? Jesus found him. Jesus found him. And there's a real point of exhortation there. Jesus was there for him. And when that interaction happened, Jesus heard that they'd cast him out, and when he had found him, I'm in the last three verses of John 9 now, he said, do you believe on the Son of God? And he answered and said, who is he, Lord, that I might believe on him? And Jesus said unto him, thou hast both seen him, and it is he that talketh with thee. Now, what happened? Do you remember what actually happened? The man couldn't see. And Jesus put a paste over his eyes, which would make certain that he couldn't see. And then Jesus went one way, and he said to this man, now, you go to the pool of Siloam and wash. He hadn't seen Jesus, even though from that point on, he could see. He hadn't yet seen Jesus. So there was quite a lot of truth in what he said to the people who challenged him and said, who did this? He said, I don't know where he is. He couldn't have recognized him anyway. Recognized his voice more than likely, but wouldn't have known what he looked like until this point in time. Who is it, Lord, that I might believe on him? And Jesus said, you have seen him, and it is he that talketh with thee. And he said, Lord, I believe. And Jesus said, for judgment I've come to this world, that they which see not might see, and they which see might be made blind. And some of the Pharisees which were with him heard these words and said, are we blind? They got the point. They got the point. Maybe they were some of the ones who said, we have Moses as the basis of our faith. And who are you? You do things like this on the Sabbath. You can't be one of Moses' children. And what Jesus said to this man, and what John builds in his gospel, was that Jesus is there for the infirmities which we have. Jesus is there for our spiritual well-being in giving the bread and the wine and the works of the Last Supper. And Jesus is there to build on the infirmities of people and show us that God is there and that God is the fountain of life. And in the raising of Lazarus and in the raising of Jesus, that point was emphasized.